May it please the Court.
You may proceed.
Lance Shockley's case cannot be viewed as reliable both as to both phases of his trial. At his trial during voir dire, Juror 58 came forward to the court to inform the court that he had a son who was a police officer and he had also was a published author. What he published was this book. This book on the front cover has blood spatter. The back cover likewise does too. On the back cover, there are themes about vengeance for murders in a court system that is unsympathetic to the plight of victims and why vengeance is needed. Counsel conceded that they were ineffective in failing to follow up with this juror 58, why being a published author was something that they ought to have explored and got at the details of what is in that book. What happened here was so outside the norm that counsel should have inquired as to why this juror was coming forward to say, I'm a published author. This is a situation that falls under this court's Nice case where prejudice can be presumed because of counsel's ineffectiveness, because a juror who could not fairly serve actually got to serve. When we look at a juror in terms of their ability to fairly serve, courts have indicated that blind deference should not be given to the juror's assertion of being able to be fair, and that a more searching inquiry on appeal is appropriate when the trial court does not engage in any of that inquiry. And in terms of not giving blind deference here, I would point the court to the overriding theme of this book, its covers. The theme of the book is about vengeance and the violent nature of how we have this. It starts out with the protagonist's mother being murdered and raped, proceeding to his wife being the victim of this accident, and then him carrying out this incredibly violent torture death of the person who's responsible for his wife's death.
Here we're addressing whether counsel was ineffective and whether that was prejudicial and not following up on saying he was a published author. So are you saying in every instance where they know someone's published, you're ineffective if you don't inquire about it? Because I guess they did inquire about the son being a policeman or son-in-law being a policeman.
I think what happened here was really out of the norm. There had been a break to discuss strikes for cause, and this juror just out of the blue comes forward and says, hey, you know, there's these two things, and you want to know I'm a published author. It wouldn't have taken anything to say to this juror, why is that important?
I understand, but isn't our question really whether failing to do that makes you ineffective? Because you only find out about the substance of what's in the book if you make that inquiry. So how do we deal with that issue, is it?
And they should have made that inquiry because they would have got at the substance of the book, and that's what how counsel testified. They would have got to the substance.
So again, if we're to hold this as ineffectiveness, what is the rule and how do we apply it in other cases? That's my concern here. If we were to say failing to ask that question was ineffective, what does that mean for future cases? That you always have to do what?
I think when counsel is presented with something that goes outside the norm, which this did, this is not an everyday occurrence where a juror approaches the court with this kind of disclosure. And I think that's what's different about this case. I mean, you could have someone who, you know, is a published author, but they wrote children's books. And, you know, all they needed to do is to find out and ask him a few questions, and they would have got at the heart of what this book is about. But also, I think it's problematic because when they're having this record that's being made, they actually went out to the web and got the summary of this juror, what he had authored, that was put out there by Barnes & Noble and Amazon. So those kinds of things counsel ought to be expected to do in terms of jurors. I mean, they should have done the prep. I mean, they had the juror list. They had the juror questionnaires. They should have been looking at these kinds of things. So I think that's what we're talking about here, something so outside the norm. And these facts, as they've played out here, are just not something that they're just beyond the pale as to what took place here.
I know you say that prejudice should be presumed here, but didn't trial counsel
say during the 2915 hearing that, you know, there were some other really good things about this juror. They really liked the fact that he was knowledgeable about guns and that guns were going to be a big part of this case. And so he couldn't, it seemed to me, based off the, what I had read of the transcript, that it was unclear whether or not it was clear to trial counsel that even if he'd known about this book, that he would have felt strongly to strike or remove this juror.
Judge, counsel testified to that, but that doesn't excuse the failure to make the question when you've got this other factor that's unusual. And while those were things that he thought were what might be helpful as a juror.
But let's say we don't find that prejudice should be presumed here and we decide that we have to assume prejudice. And isn't there a problem here that of establishing prejudice under these circumstances?
If this juror was not able to fairly serve, then prejudice is presumed, because that's what this court has held in Anderson and Nice. If the juror was unfair and couldn't serve, then prejudice is presumed, so that's not a problem.
If they would have been removed for cause.
They could have been struck for cause, and that's what our contention is. They could have been struck for cause here. And counsel testified, I mean, he argued when it came to light so intensely that this juror, he would have struck him for cause had he known these facts. And counsel conceded in his testimony, I should have made this inquiry. Both counsel did. They both testified they should have made the inquiry. There was no strategic reason for failing to do this. So even though there may have been some facts about this juror that had some appeal, counsel said I should have made this inquiry when I was put on notice of something that was out of the norm. And that's what this is, out of the norm, when you have this juror just coming forward to the court to volunteer both these things.
Could we focus on another time during the trial when this issue came up, and that is regarding the defense counsel's waiver, affirmative waiver of the trial court's offer to hold a hearing on jury misconduct. Is that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel?
It absolutely is, Your Honor. It's one of the points in our brief. And the trial court gave them the opportunity to basically elicit all the things that were elicited in this post-conviction action.
And in the direct appeal, at that point, there was no evidence in the record, and that was the basis of the court's ruling, to know that the juror had given the book to other jurors.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. On direct appeal, this court said that the arguments that were being made about this juror and the book being distributed to other jurors was speculative because there was no evidence. But Judge Evans, in his letter, expressly invited counsel to do that. And I've cited a case in my brief. It's out. It's called, I believe, Stotts, in which what reasonable counsel does when this juror misconduct is they call the juror at the motion for new trial hearing and have the court hear the evidence. And that's what this counsel should have done. It couldn't have been even any clearer. I mean, Judge Evans was inviting them. He sent them a letter saying, you know, this is something you may want to consider. If you're going to do it, let me know, because I think we need to at least plot out a course how this will be handled and handled respectfully.
The motion court found that there was no misconduct on the part of the juror in giving the book to other jurors because he could reasonably have misunderstood the directions of the trial court in not to give materials that have to do with, he thought it was limited to trials, where in fact the admonition of the court was also included crime. But part of his justification in his testimony was that his book was a love story. Is that an honest assessment of the nature of his book?
I think it is not an honest assessment of the nature of his book. I think to characterize his book as a love story is just so outside what is reasonable. And I think it goes to show that what this juror was, you know, he was not able to fairly serve, because to represent in sworn testimony this is a love story. And when he testified, he also, when he was asked about the themes in his book, he intensely denied that those were the themes of his book. And that's set forth in my reply brief. He says, absolutely not, those are not mine. But then counsel presented to him the Barnes and Noble and Amazon bio of his book that he wrote, and then he has to back off. So I really think those facts go to strongly showing that this juror was not someone who could fairly serve. And I think there's other conduct about what took place in addition to characterizing it as a love story. He also testifies his theme about lenient judges and criminal defendants he characterizes as a small, minor part of his book. And we've set forth in detail the kinds of really intense views that are expressed in that book. And it is not a small, minor part of his book, but that was how he testified.
But the testimony from the other jurors were that they maybe read two or three pages, or how much of the book did other jurors testify they had read?
They testified, some of them testified they scanned it, they looked at it. Juror number three, and when you look at juror 58's testimony, juror three read the back cover, and juror 58, who's the one in question, testified that juror three gave him feedback about his book. The other jurors 50 and 117, they took the book, and when they looked at it, they realized that they shouldn't have taken it. And anyone who, I think, looks at the front or the back cover of this book and reads the back cover of the book really can recognize that this book is not appropriate in light of Judge Evans' instructions about trials and criminal proceedings. It just does not. I mean, it's obvious to them. I mean, I would point the court to my reply brief at page 31. There's a diagram that I set forth on that diagram, and it lists the people who are concerned about that. The diagram lists Judge Evans, Judge Evans' secretary, the deputy, jurors 117, juror 150, the juror coordinator, and Michelle Nigliazio. They all immediately, they were appalled. Ms. Nigliazio testified. She was so upset. We were Johnny on the spot is the terms that she used and how to present this. But not only did Judge Evans give this instruction at the beginning, after Judge Evans gave this specific instruction that we've set forth in our brief, Ms. Nigliazio got up and reiterated the same sorts of sentiment. And she testified that it was made very clear to all these jurors that this is the kind of material that has no business being before the jury. And she was just like overwhelmed by
it. If the evidence supports that he intentionally engaged in misconduct, then is there a presumption of prejudice?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think the kinds of things that we've been discussing here show an intent to fail to disclose disqualifying factors. And prejudice is presumed. And on the second point in our brief, which goes to counsel's ineffectiveness, this could have been developed at the motion for new trial hearing. And trial counsel's reasons for not doing things at the motion for new trial hearing is that they were hoping that the judge would just not give death. And one of the testimony was they weren't aware of any case where a judge had given death. Well, you have a duty at the motion for new trial hearing when this kind of conduct has gone on to call the people who can support your claim. In this case, it would have been the jurors, juror 58, the judge's secretary, the bailiff, security person. So all of those factors could have been done, presented at the motion for new trial hearing, and would have established that Judge Evans should have granted a new trial at that point. And even if he didn't, if it came up to this court, there would have been a record that this court did not have on direct appeal. And that was really, this court's reasoning on direct appeal is that this court said it's all speculative because there is no evidence. And that was the terminology that this court used to reject the claims about this juror.
Is the presumption of prejudice rebuttable?
No. If we have an unqualified juror, it's not rebuttable. It is not. And Anderson and Nice stand for that proposition. When you have a juror who is unqualified to serve, prejudice is presumed, and this is a Nice kind of case or an Anderson kind of case.
And the issue is this juror, not whether other jurors were influenced by the book.
As far as him serving, our claims that go to him serving, yes. But we've got separate claims that go to really how this really created a situation like the Post case where you can't view this as a reliable determination on either phase. Because it's so called into question, the reliability is there. The jury process of being sequestered has been so tainted. And that's what happened in Post when you had deputies and jurors partying together and having sex together. Well, this is a similar kind of thing, but I think it's more egregious because his book is an indictment of the court system and specifically how judges and courts handle criminal defendants. So it goes to the substance of what the juror is being required to decide. I'm in the red zone, and if the court has more questions, I'll answer them now. If not, I'll wait for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. To be entitled to the presumption of regarding from an unfair jury, there first has to be showing that the jury was not, in fact, fair and impartial in this case, and that showing was not made in this proceeding.
Well, if you have an unqualified juror, that's not the case. Our cases are clear that if you have someone, an unqualified juror, someone who should have been stricken for cause, certainly it's clear, then you don't have to show anything else.
If that showing is made, and what I'm arguing is that showing was not made in the first place. As to Juror 58, if he was really so biased that he was trying to get on this jury to fulfill some kind of personal agenda, why would he even volunteer in the first place that he wrote a book? He could have kept his mouth shut. No one would ever have known about it.
Seems to have been very proud of his efforts.
He was. But I think he was also very clear, and in accordance with what this court suggested on direct appeal, that he wrote these to make an entertaining story, not because he felt that way personally. And I think that goes back to the whole voir dire issue, is because even if he'd been questioned about this book on voir dire, the simple fact that he wrote it would not in and of itself have supported a strike for cause. There would have had to have been, I think, some showing that yes, this reflects what he really believes, and he cannot be fair and impartial. And that showing certainly wasn't made at the 2915 hearing, and we have no way of knowing what information he would have disclosed in response to questioning on voir dire. There's no reason to believe that he would have said anything different than what he said during the 2915 hearing. I think the motion court correctly found, though, that based on those statements, a strike for cause would not have been sustained in this particular instance.
You argue that in response to his testimony that he thought it was a love story and didn't think it had any real chance of falling under the prohibition, and that you say one can quibble over whether it fell within the admonition. So if I read that book, you believe that I will find that one can honestly quibble over whether it fell within the admonition?
As far as whether it's a book about crimes or not, that I think the juror is right that that really is not the major part of the story. In fact, you have to go several chapters through it to even get to that part, and it does not take up a significant part of the book. So
how about the vengeance for too lenient treatment and the defendant hoodwinking the court to give him that lenient treatment?
Well, I suppose that depends on whether one views that admonition as qualitative or quantitative. Now, perhaps as a quantitative matter, it could certainly be viewed as finding that it does fall within that admonition. The juror was perhaps looking at it as a qualitative as far as the amount of space given to it. His assessment perhaps was wrong. I'm not going to say necessarily that he was viewing it correctly. I think subjectively, I don't think he acted in bad faith. But again, I think the key point here is that if he did violate this order, that in and of itself does not entitle the defendant to a new trial. There has to be a showing that his actions somehow influenced the jury, caused the trial not to be fair.
If the record shows that his actions were intentional, do you have to show it influenced the jury?
Because I think you still
doesn't that disqualify him? In it's don't the cases say intentional misconduct is prejudice that requires reversal?
But there is no evidence in here to support that he intentionally did it. I mean, basically, you would have to engage in inferences perhaps that are contrary to what the evidence showed, contrary to the motion court's finding?
I think that's why the questions are about the book. If any reasonable person looking at the book would think this was clearly about vengeance and a trial and a crime and was not a love story, if it doesn't pass the smell test, then can't you infer his intent from that? And don't you have to even? Because that's not, calling it a love story is not credible.
Well, I would say it kind of depends on what you mean by a love story. Now, obviously, this isn't a love story.
Well, love of vengeance is not what...
Well, except I think, and I'm not saying this is how he views it, but I'm saying one way you could view it is that his actions, his vengeance, and all of that was motivated by his love for his wife and his son, and that's what caused him to act in the way he did. That may not be traditionally what we think of as a love story. I'm not even saying for sure that's what the author thought, because he didn't expound on that. But I don't think it's completely out of the realm of possibility to look at it in that way. But again, I think what we're dealing with is somebody who wrote a book and was proud of it, exercised some poor judgment about the manner in which he handled it, but not a book that necessarily reflected the way he felt about the criminal justice system. It was not, I don't believe, a deliberate attempt to try and affect this trial. Certainly would not have affected his views, and the jurors that were exposed to it all were pretty clear that it did not affect their views. And I think the idea that simply looking at a cover and perhaps a blurb is frankly pretty insulting to the jurors to think that they couldn't go beyond that and still consider the evidence and deliver a verdict on the evidence. And even the juror that did look at a few pages of it, I think only read the first three or four. And again, if you look at this book, you have to go several pages into it.
One said they scanned the whole thing, but there's two separate issues. One is he so biased as shown by the book that he's disqualified? Because even one juror, doesn't matter, you're entitled to 12 jurors in our cases, are very clear and specific. Right. Anyone? And the second is, did the influence other jurors, particularly by the one who scanned it and the one who read a few pages and talking about it? So those are really different issues.
Right.
If for some reason he's not automatically excluded.
But again, I think the court found credible his assessments that you know, this book does not reflect what I really believe about the justice system. I was trying to tell a story, an entertaining story that will try to get people to buy my book and to read my book. And there's no basis, I think, in the record to overturn that particular testimony or the court's adoption of the credibility of that testimony. We just have to, again, the evidence just doesn't support the finding that the juror was disqualified.
How do we look at the fact that all the jurors who looked at it thought, oh, this is within the prohibition, I shouldn't be looking at this?
Well, actually, if you look at the testimony of the jurors, what they basically said was they weren't interested in it or they didn't think it was appropriate. They had to be prodded, really, by defense counsel and reminded even of the prohibition before they would come around and say, well, maybe that didn't fall into it. It's not at all clear to me from reading the transcript that at the time they were deciding not to read it further, they were thinking, oh, the court said not to bring these, and this is part of that, so I better not read it. They just didn't find it was appropriate to read or something that they were interested in. One juror basically, and this is the juror who actually had the book given to her by her husband. Mm-hmm. I mean, this juror 58 didn't even give the book to her. And she was like, you know, I just don't have time for this. I've got better things to think about. I'll just deal with it at some later date. That was her reason for not looking at the book. Again, whether it was clearly something that was in the court's prohibition, and again, the reasoning behind it, if you look at when counsel made the request, is we don't want the jurors reading books that might give them ideas about, oh, you've got to have this evidence, you've got to have this CSI forensic evidence. That was the idea. Don't be reading crime books that might somehow subtly influence the way you look at the case. This guy brought a book that he wrote. He wasn't bringing it to read himself, so I don't think it's even necessarily clear that by bringing the book that he considered himself to be violating the order because he wasn't doing what the court was intending to prohibit. Now, shouldn't have shared it with the other jurors. There's no question about that. But again, absent any evidence that those jurors actually were influenced by the book, that action does not entitle the defendant to a new trial. I don't know that I've got anything that's coming to mind on that's not already in the briefs, but if the court has other questions on that or anything else, we'd ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Could you address the evidence is regarding the presence of law enforcement during the trial?
Well, there was certainly evidence that there was the law enforcement was outside the courthouse and that the defendant was escorted to and from court by heavily armed officers and wearing a bulletproof vest, because apparently there was some segment of the population, at least, that was somewhat incited against him in making threats. Now, what the counsel testified to was that they were aware of no instances where the defendant was transported by officers in the presence of the jury, that all happened separately, the jury's transport to and from the courthouse, the transport of the defendant to and from the courthouse. No witness, as I recall, ever specifically said the jury saw this police presence. And of course, because we're in a 2915 case where the movement bears the burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence, there was failure to show by a preponderance of the evidence that the jury was somehow exposed to an unreasonable police presence that would have influenced their decision in the case.
Was the evidence that there were 50 to 100 officers present in the courthouse? Was there evidence whether the jury saw those 50 to 100 officers?
There was no evidence that the jury saw anyone, and I think the testimony about that large number in the courthouse came from a relative of the defendant. The attorneys, I think, were all fairly clear and that they were not aware of any instances where the jury was exposed to any kind of unusual police presence.
Does the state have a position on how many officers were there? I assume they were all there because it was an office. It was a killing of an officer.
I don't have any facts other than what's contained in the record of this particular case. And again, it sounds from the evidence, the bulk of the evidence, that most of what happened was you had officers providing security to the defendant as he was going back and forth. One of the counsel said that officers that were in the courtroom sitting behind the defense table were in civilian clothes. I'm not aware of any record that firmly establishes uniformed officers sitting as spectators. Possibly happened, but I can't say that was the case. Again, the evidence in its totality and the evidence that the court found credible indicates the jury was not exposed to any improper number of uniformed or armed police officers.
Thank you.
Juror 117 and juror 50 were clear. They knew from looking at this book when they looked at it, it was not appropriate under the court's instructions. If you look at the testimony, and it's cited in my brief, I don't think the state's representation of what these jurors testified to is a fair representation. They were very clear. They returned the book and thought it was improper under Judge Evans's instruction. I would encourage this court, like I've cited the case called Holloman in my brief, and it's a case that looks at not giving blind deference to what jurors profess about their ability to be fair. And I think when you look at all the things here, at the outset, this juror, when he's questioned, he disavows his theme, saying, no, absolutely not. And when he's confronted with the Barnes & Noble piece that he authored and wrote, he has to back off. The book is not a love story in any way, shape, or form. It just isn't, no matter how the state might want to cast it as a love story. This is not what I think. And it just is not recognizable and is not a fair representation to call this a love story. When juror 58 is asked about the theme in his book about it being lenient judges and criminal defendants getting just way too off easily, he says that's a small, minor part of his book. But really, the driving force of what takes place in this book is all about criminal defendants getting too easy treatment by judges. And he specifically focuses on, and those portions are quoted from his book and they're in my brief, about he focuses on judges who allow people to get off too easily. It's a general condemnation of the court system and how criminal defendants, and specifically homicide defendants, are treated. He also, when he was questioned at his deposition, he refused to concede that Judge Evans gave the instruction that he did about avoiding things relating to legal matters or crimes and those kinds of things. He would not even acknowledge that. And he saw no problem about passing this out and distributing it to other jurors. And I think this really goes back to a situation like Post, where you cannot rely on what took place here as to either phase. He was a biased juror for the reasons I've just highlighted. The state says the fact that he came forward and volunteered this shows that he wasn't trying to be deceptive or whatever. I don't think we can really discern why this individual came forward to volunteer. He was a published author. When you look at it in the context of all his subsequent behaviors, of giving this out to other jurors and discussing, he said that he got feedback from juror three when juror three read the back cover, discussing the content of his book with other jurors. So, and everyone outside of himself, and this is on page 31 of my reply brief, I have a chart set out. I really urge the court to look at that and how it breaks down as to everyone else is consistent saying, you know, there's reason to question this. The deputy recognized this was problematic when the book was given by juror 58 to him and brought it to the judge's secretary saying, hey, Judge Evans may want to be on notice of this. So people who just touched this book, and that's all you have to do is look at the front cover with it and the back cover. It has the blood spatter. And read the back cover with its theme. You know what this book is about. And that's how these jurors, juror 117 and juror 50, testified. I didn't have to look at this long to know it was outside the bounds of what, you know, Judge Evans had really, and Ms. Nigliazzo had impressed upon us was so critical in this case for the fairness of this case. And Judge Evans and Ms. Nigliazzo did everything they could, but this is really a juror who is just outside the bounds of what is acceptable conduct. And he knew that. He testified that he took four copies of his book after they were released to go home and get their personal belongings. Why would you take four copies of this book unless you were intending to disseminate it amongst other people? And that's what he did. It's so outrageous, the idea that a jury can be exposed to these views and in a capital case.
Well, could you clarify a fact for me? Was the hearing, the time frame of the hearing that was offered by Judge Evans, was that before or after the filing of the motion for new trial?
The motion for new trial was filed. And then Judge Evans sent his letter saying, I've been trying to communicate with you folks, and I've asked you to return calls to me about what we're going to do. Please advise me if we're going to call jurors. He invited them to call jurors. And on the direct appeal opinion, this court really harshly criticizes counsel for presenting a speculative opinion because, and this court said, we're not going to fault Judge Evans. He gave them every opportunity to prove their claim and prove this juror could not serve. I'm in the red zone. If the court has more questions, I'm happy to continue. If not, then I'll conclude and ask for relief, if that's okay. Does the court have any more questions? I ask this court to reverse, because what took place here is so outrageous that a capital defendant could be sentenced to death under these circumstances when a juror brings his book and disseminates it to the jury, in which he did with the themes that he had. I ask this court to reverse and order a new trial. Thank you very much.